This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents In the Enemy's House, the secret saga of the FBI agent and the codebreaker who caught the Russian spies, by Howard Bloom, read by David Colacci. I stood in the vestibule of the enemy's house, having entered by stealth. I had no idea where the corridors in the KGB's edifice would take us, or what we would find when we reached the end of the search. But the keys were ours, and we were determined to use them. FBI Counterintelligence Supervisor Bob Lamphere. Naught's had, all spent, where our desire is got without content. 'Tis safer to be that which we destroy than by destruction dwell in doubtful joy. William Shakespeare, Macbeth. A note to the reader. The main foreign intelligence arm of the Russian state has been reorganized and renamed several times throughout its history. For the sake of clarity and convenience, it is called the KGB in this account. That was the organization's final name before the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Prologue. The storks fly away. Bob Lamphere stared at the phone, waiting, willing it to ring. It was the tail end of the afternoon on a perfect late spring day, June 19, 1953, in Washington, D.C., the time of day when Bob liked to have a restorative scotch and soda. Instead, Bob, usually so rock-steady, calm even in crisis to the point of detachment, found himself in the fifth-floor office of his boss, the assistant director of the FBI, anxiously staring at the phone, waiting. If there was one thing Bob should have learned in his 12 years as an FBI agent, in all the long days and longer nights he'd spent on espionage cases, it was how to wait. He had sat in parked cars until his legs grew stiff, stood with stolid discipline under leaky awnings in the teeming rain, huddled down low in his seat in the back of movie theaters. Physical surveillance, the Bureau manual insisted, was an essential skill for field work. Any agent, especially one like Bob, who had risen to the rank of supervisor in the intelligence division, either learned patience or went looking for another job. But there had never been a wait like this. Bob tried telling himself he had done what he could. He had written, damn the consequences, a blunt memo to J. Edgar Hoover, stating that the facts of the case were clear. At the very least, the wife did not deserve her sentence. She should not be executed. And the director, in a response that filled Bob with both surprise and a measure of respect, swiftly put this argument into a letter that he signed with his looping schoolboy cursive and had hand-delivered to the judge. The judge, however, would not be persuaded. He was adamant. If the prisoners did not cooperate, the sentence would be enforced just before nightfall. Now all Bob could do was stare at the phone. It was a direct line to the death house in Sing Sing prison. Al Belmont, the hard-edged, by-the-book assistant director of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division, whom Bob had known since their quarrelsome days years ago working in the New York field office, was in charge of the command post. In Belmont's suit jacket pocket he had a typed list of questions that Bob, in a wishful burst of optimism, had helped prepare. Two stenographers were on call in an adjacent room. And further down a long, dimly lit prison corridor, behind a steel door with the word silence above the lintel, was the electric chair. There would be two reasons for the phone to ring in the fifth-floor office in the Justice Department building in Washington. Either the two prisoners had finally agreed to provide pertinent information, or they would have received 3 jolts of electricity, 2,000 volts for 3 seconds, dropping to 500 volts for 57 seconds so as not to cook the flesh, another 2,000 volts steadying to 500 volts, and a final 2,000-volt surge, and were now dead. The office grew crowded, and Bob knew all the newcomers. He had done some things, been in some difficult places with a few of them. But Bob was in no mood for reminiscing. He remained quiet, aloof, locked in his own tight circle of dread. After a while, Bob's eyes wandered absently about the room. Heavy blue curtains framed a double window, and when he looked out, he saw that long gray shadows were starting to stretch across the courtyard below. The sun was setting, and all at once his blood ran cold. At about the same time, a half hour's drive into suburban Virginia from downtown Washington, Meredith Gardner, Bob's unlikely collaborator and no less improbably good friend, was suffering his own pangs of guilt. The evening in the modest one-story ranch that sat in the cul-de-sac off Old Dominion Drive had been, at least at first, routine. Meredith had been determined to push from his mind the grim events unfolding in Sing Sing prison and the role he had covertly played in this drama. Restraint was natural to his demeanor, just as it was a necessity in his secret life. And so, as usual on Friday night, there had been a family dinner. Blanche, a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Mount Holyoke, who had done her own hush-hush government work during the war, cooked for her husband and the two children. After the table was cleared and the children had gone off to play, Meredith, his tie still knotted tightly, a glass of sweet sherry within reach on the end table, sat in the living room with his wife. They were at opposite corners of the room, each in identical wing chairs covered in an identical floral print, each with a book in their hands. What were they reading? It could have been, almost literally, anything. The family library was both obscure and eclectic. A Slovak grammar primer, a Spanish-language history of Turkey, an analysis of slavery in the Bible, a Chinese-Russian dictionary, all were well-thumbed. Books crowded the small house like wild and tangling vines. Volumes spilled out from a pair of tall, mahogany-stained bookshelves, cluttered tabletops, and were stacked in knee-high piles on the floor, so that walking from one room to the next was as difficult as navigating a maze. Meredith relished this evening ritual, this period of quiet community with his wife, and tonight it was a refuge that was deeply needed. Then suddenly the lights in the house went out, and in that same moment their 8-year-old son, Arthur, let out a hair-raising howl. Meredith hurried into the children's room. He found his frightened son with his thumb wedged into the wall socket, and Anne, their 4-year-old daughter, sitting complacently in the electric chair. Or that was how a teary Arthur, after his finger, albeit without most of the nail, was carefully extricated from the socket, identified the contraption in which he had placed his little sister. A good deal of planning had clearly gone into building the device. Arthur had taken the child's car seat from the family Studebaker, wrapped the frame with a pair of wires connected to the transmitter that powered his electric trains, and then attempted to complete the electrical circuit by inserting the wires into the socket. He'd imagined a burst of electricity surging up through the car seat and giving his sister a mean tickle. Instead, he'd managed to short all the fuses in the basement fuse box and given himself the shock of his life. Once he'd gotten the lights back on, and was certain that neither of his children was seriously injured, Meredith confronted his son. "What in heaven's name were you thinking?" he demanded. "Why, of all things, would you want to build an electric chair?" Meredith's voice was, as always, soft, measured, precise. Yet there was a telltale clue to his mood. When he was angry, a southern twang, the vestige of a childhood in Mississippi and Texas, would become more pronounced. At this moment, the lilt was unmistakable.
"Papa, I heard you and Mama talking. I wanted to see what it was," the boy said.
He went on, hurriedly, desperate to be exonerated.
"I was playing. It was a game. I didn't want to hurt Anne."
Meredith stared at Arthur, but did not respond. It was as if his mind had abruptly wandered off, and now his distracted silence filled the room. At last he kissed his son gently on the top of the head and walked off. Only years later would he explain to his son a bit about what he'd been thinking then. That he, too, had been caught up in what had started as a game, an intellectual challenge, a rigorous test of wits even more daunting than any of the London Times crossword puzzles he so relished. He had never considered the consequences. He had never imagined his actions, the deductions that had previously filled him with pride, the long chase, that any of this could result in two gruesome deaths, could leave two young boys orphaned. After Arthur was in his pajamas, when it was time to say good night, the boy went looking for his father. He found him sitting on the wooden picnic bench in the backyard, alone, apparently lost in thought, with the darkness of the late June evening closing in. Far off, across the world, it was a pre-dawn morning in the weathered yellow-brick building on Lubyanka Square in Moscow. Inside the KGB headquarters, or Moscow Center, as the spy fortress was known, Alexander Feklisov sat in the first directorate staff office. He had arrived after midnight. Sleep had proved impossible. He could not push what was happening in America from his mind. He had tried to leave the apartment on Peschenia Street without awakening his wife, but it was difficult to move about in the cramped space and not make noise. Still, Zina did not ask him where he was going or why. She was used to the eccentric hours of his profession. Now he sat in the large room with its pale green walls, a space corridors away from his own small office in the British section, waiting for the clock to strike 3 a.m., the shortwave radio already tuned for the hourly update broadcast by the BBC World News Service. Like the two Americans, men he had never met but whose files he had carefully read, he continued to hope against all reason that there would be a last-minute reprieve. As the top of the hour relentlessly approached, as he, too, struggled to come to terms with a somber, looming fear, the tense events gave a dangerous edge to his memory. A long-forgotten evening intruded, and he found himself recalling the last time he had seen his agent, the friend he called Libby. It had been in a Hungarian restaurant, the Golden Fiddle, on the west side of Manhattan. Feklisov, Sasha to his comrades in the spy trade, had chosen the restaurant after considerable deliberation. It was a comfortable place with white tablecloths and heavy flatware, and served a hearty, spicy goulash they could wash down with carafes of an inexpensive yet pleasant Portuguese red. And good conspirazia. A small orchestra played gypsy music, so they'd be able to talk freely without fear of being overheard. It would be, he'd decided, the perfect setting. Sasha waited until the meal was done and the waiter had removed the empty dinner plates.
"I have to give you some news," he said softly, leaning across the table. "I'm about to leave New York in a very short time. I'm going back home."
Libby seemed unnerved by the announcement.
"What do you mean?" he asked after a moment. "You're leaving me? Why?" "You know the normal stay abroad is 3 to 4 years. I have been here for 5.5 years.
"So?"
"So if I stay too much longer, you know who might start getting suspicious."
"You're sure you can't stay longer?"
"It's not my call," Sasha said, as if making an apology.
Handlers are taught to instill confidence in their agents, to be father, mentor, confessor, all in one. How else can they persuade them to take such chances, to put themselves in such danger? But that evening Sasha couldn't help feeling that Libby, now that the news had been shared, was trying to reassure him. That was why, when the orchestra had stopped playing, Libby had risen from the table, approached the bald violinist with the gaunt, chiseled cheekbones, and after pressing some cash into his hand, told him what he wanted to hear. The musician came to the table and fell into a slow, melancholic tune.
"Do you know what that song was?" Libby had asked when he finished.
"A Hungarian song called The Storks Fly Away."
At the time, Sasha had been touched. He thought his agent was telling him that change is inevitable, yet life goes on. The ring of spies, these heroes of Mother Russia, will continue, will endure, just as one season inevitably follows another, just as the storks fly away only to return. But sitting safely in Moscow Center, Sasha could not help but be branded by his own self-deception. He had not understood at all what Libby, full of stoic resignation, had been telling him. Only now he did. At this unsettled hour, there was no disguising the reality. He had flown away, and he, and the center, had left Libby, had left all of them, on their own, with no chance of escape. And all he could offer in return for their courage and sacrifice was his remorse. They waited, and as they continued their solitary vigils, as the announcement from Sing Sing prison pushed closer and closer, the three men shared a common predicament. They had all served as soldiers in a secret war that had done nothing less than change world history. They had all believed in the righteousness of their cause, in the excesses of their enemy. They had all paid high prices, but never considered it a sacrifice. Yet at this moment, with every tick of the clock pounding in their heads like a hammer on an anvil, each of them could not help feeling he had done something unforgivable, something that had deeply violated his own sense of honor. How had it come to this?
Part 1. The Blue Problem. 1. The incident in Chinatown changed everything for Bob Lamphere. Without warning, it had come down in an instant to this: gun drawn, an angry crowd pressing in on him, and his target fixed in his sights. A volley of enraged, keening voices rose up behind him, but Bob pushed all the noise out of his mind. His focus narrowed, and his finger increased its pressure on the steel trigger. He was ready, his mind set, to fire. Until that moment in the winter of 1944, Bob had been convinced that the FBI didn't offer him what he wanted from the world. Its sensibility grated with all those rigid regulations. A tow rope missing from a government tugboat generated as much paperwork as a murder investigation, he complained, with the powerful insistence on an even more intrusive personal conformity. The required snap-brim hats and starched white shirts, the regulation bureau briefcase. This wasn't for him. He'd put in another year or two, he thought, until the war ended, and then there'd be plenty of opportunities for an ambitious young man with a law degree. And, as he knew only too well, the bureau, for that matter, was disenchanted with him. Hoover favored straight arrows, and Bob was having a hard time playing that role. There'd be no protests when he moved on. His departure would be dismissed, if anything was said at all, as part of the normal attrition. It hadn't always been like that. When Bob, just 23, had joined the FBI back in September 1941, he'd been gung-ho, energized by the wistful notion that once his probationary period was over, he'd be in the front line of an elite group of derring-do lawmen, continuing in the great tradition of the Tommy-gun-toting G-men who'd relentlessly chased down John Dillinger. Fawning newspaper reports regularly proclaimed that the FBI were the best that law enforcement had to offer, and Bob, who had no small sense of pride, was certain that was where he belonged. And, another vanity, he was confident he looked the part. Square-jawed, broad-shouldered, thick black hair with a precise part, and, not least,
deep brown eyes that would routinely hold a person with a gaze as steady as a marksman's. He wasn't a big man, maybe a tad over 5'10" if he made an effort to stand erect, a trim welterweight, but he had a presence. Handsome in an even-featured, all-American way, a man's man, someone you just knew at a glance had grown up fishing in mountain streams and hunting deer in deep woods. Yet while that was true, Bob nevertheless hadn't had much of a childhood. He'd been raised in Mullen, Idaho, a small, hard-scrabble mining town flunked down in a high canyon overshadowed by the formidable Coeur d'Alene Mountains. His father, a no-nonsense disciplinarian with a quick temper, was what people in those parts knew as a leaser. The way Joe Lamphere had it figured, it made more sense to lease a mine and hire hands to work for him than to have to answer to some know-it-all mine owner. Besides, each time he'd signed on for work in one of the big silver mines, it was never long before he went off on a tear about one thing or another to the shift boss. The man in charge would respond by muttering something dismissive and often crude, Joe would let loose with an angry punch, and the next thing Joe knew, he'd be given his walking papers. Running things himself, then, made a lot more sense, although the economics of it were often precarious. In contrast to her husband's fitful rages, Lily Lamphere was a preternaturally calm, almost taciturn presence, as seemingly bland and unassuming as the flat Minnesota country near the banks of the Leaf River where she'd been raised. Or, perhaps as some relatives speculated, her seeming withdrawal from family life, if not the world, was simply a defense against Joe's pugnacious bluster. When she wasn't cooking, she'd be deep into some book. She'd run the post office in quiet Trout Lake, Minnesota. There were more fish in the lake than people in the town, the locals were fond of saying, for several years when they'd first been married, and had taken to spending the vacant hours escaping into whatever book she could find. Lily had a fondness for Jane Austen, but the Bible was her favorite. You could turn to any page and learn something, she liked to say. With his two incompatible parents locked into their own disparate worlds, Bob grew up as the overlooked middle child. The way he remembered it, he was pretty much always on his own, which suited him fine. There was nothing he liked better than heading up into the hills, wandering about on the ridgeline with his .22 rifle and his mongrel hunting dog, out of sight of people from dawn to dusk. Still, Bob was both of his parents' son. He had his dad's temper, all right. He got into his share of fights at school. The immigrant Finnish miners' sons in Mullen saw him as an outsider, and even though he was outnumbered, he wouldn't take their guff. It was rough going for a while. But after he took some boxing lessons, putting in strenuous hours on the heavy bag and sparring nearly to the point of utter exhaustion day after day in the ring, he was able to give as good as he got. It was a rough-and-tumble skill that came in handy when he was older and worked summers in his father's mine. His father made it a point that Bob should pull the worst jobs, sticking him deep in the hole so nobody could say that Joe Lamphere was playing favorites. Nevertheless, there were always a few ornery miners who'd try to give the boss's son a hard time, and Bob would invariably only take so much before he'd call them on it. Fists would fly, and at the end, more often than not, he'd be the one left standing. From his mother, Bob had inherited a love of reading. History, particularly books about the Civil War, kept him occupied as he lay in bed before falling off to sleep. And the more he read, the more Bob came to realize that books and education could be his path out of a life in the mines. He'd spent too many summers twisting the sweat out of his socks each night after climbing up from the dark, suffocatingly hot hole, not to want something else for himself. So he set his sights on getting into college. Bob liked to challenge himself, and he did well enough in high school to be accepted into the University of Idaho's accelerated law program. In 5 years, he'd earned both his law and his bachelor's degree. But then, in 1940, out of the blue, his mother took sick, and, as if in an instant, she was gone. And now Bob could see no reason for sticking around in Idaho. The way he rationalized things, his father, who had grown sickly over the last few years, wouldn't last long without his wife. It would be a kindness if Bob spared his old man the burden of financing his final year of law school. Bob would enroll somewhere else, find himself a job, and pay his own tuition. Yet even bolstered by all this comforting, altruistic logic, part of him knew he just was ready to get out of Idaho. He was eager to put some distance between all he'd endured while growing up and his future. Bob wound up in Washington, D.C., a quaintly genteel southern city in the early 1940s, that nevertheless seemed a cosmopolitan world away from the isolated northern Idaho hill country. He found a clerk's job in the Treasury Department, a menial entry-level bit of paper pushing. But it paid him enough to cover the tuition for night classes at National Law School. And while his 9-to-5 workday was set in stone, the job was undemanding, so he could find time to study, too. His days and nights were full. Bob, in fact, was too busy to return to Mullen for his father's funeral. And anyway, his father, knowing his time was running out, had written to tell his son not to interrupt his studies for his sake when the time inevitably came. In 1941, Bob not only got his degree, but without the help of a cram course, passed the D.C. bar on his first try. And now Bob began to think seriously about what he'd do next. He set off, brimming with confidence. The world of government, as he envisioned it, was his oyster. After all, the New Deal had lavishly expanded the federal bureaucracy. There had to be plenty of jobs available for a young lawyer. Yet once he began knocking on doors throughout official Washington, Bob quickly began to understand that a law degree was one thing, and connections, political, school, and family, were another, and a lot more valuable. But as fate would have it, just as he was wondering if it might make sense to return to Idaho, where people at least knew the Lamphers, one of his professors happened to mention that the FBI had sent word to the law schools in the district. The Bureau was looking for candidates. This applicant presents a fair appearance, and during the interview he was chewing about 4 sticks of gum. He is timid in approach, and his personality is leaning toward the negative side. The recommendation is unfavorable. That was how the Bureau's initial interviewer sized Bob up. But from Bob's perspective, or so he'd suggest years later, when all his subsequent success went a long way toward invalidating this dismal appraisal, Mr. Wilcox, with typical Bureau rigidity, had just been trying to shove him into a box where he'd never fit. Where the FBI saw timidity, Bob saw quiet confidence. He didn't feel any need to bang any drums on his own behalf. As for his negative personality, Bob put that down to his tendency to weigh both sides of any proposition. And as for his chewing gum, well, Bob would concede, with a mature embarrassment, that you could take the boy out of Idaho, but you couldn't take Idaho out of the boy. Yes, he'd later acknowledge, at 23, he still had to get used to big city ways. Yet someone in the Bureau must have had some appreciation of Bob's qualities, because, despite the interviewer's grumpy evaluation, on September 16, 1941, he received a letter signed by J. Edgar Hoover. "You are hereby offered an appointment as a special agent in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, United States Department of Justice, in grade CAF-9, with a salary at the rate of $3,200 per annum." There were 50 fledgling G-men in Bob's class at Quantico, the Marine base in Virginia where the FBI had its training center. He was the youngest, and yet he was, he'd acknowledge with a contrarian's pride, more than a bit brash when thrown into the competitive instructional exercises. It was, as he recalled, a group cut pretty much from the same calico cloth. Small-town boys, mostly from the Midwest, white, Protestant, and, like their revered Director Hoover, staunch patriots and no less staunch political conservatives. And their timing in joining the Bureau, they congratulated one another, pumped with their new-found camaraderie, was propitious. They had signed on at a great moment in history, the winds of war and unrest blowing across the globe. Nazism, fascism, communism, these hostile isms were the new enemies that would replace the John Dillingers. Heroes in the making, they were to a man eager to join the fight against the insidious forces determined to infiltrate and subvert America. But before they could be dispatched into this seething, complicated new world, they had to be trained for the task. It was a demanding process. Classes were from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., Monday through Saturday, with just a half day on Sunday as a grudging concession to the Sabbath. They shot 38 pistols and Tommy guns until they could routinely cluster their shots in the center of the target, flip their opponents onto gym mats with exotic jiu-jitsu moves, lifted fingerprints off the most unpromising surfaces, learned how to testify in a clear, concise English in the courtroom, and made sure to say yes, sir, and no, sir, to practically everyone they encountered. And throughout the whole grueling process, two articles of faith, two inviolable tenets, were constantly drummed in. One, you'd better not screw up. If you displeased a superior, or, heaven help you, Mr. Hoover, your career would be over in an ignominious instant. There was no civil service protection, and, as a consequence, there were no second chances. There was only the director's iron prerogative. And two, the FBI was the best of the best, and you were expected to be better than all other lawmen in every category. Nothing less would be tolerated. Yet all the training, all the indoctrination, only made the waiting all the harder. When the 16 weeks were finally over, after Bob had passed the final exam and had been given his credentials, his gold badge, and his 38, he rejoiced. At last, his great, new, important adventure was about to begin. 2. Bob, the stern-jawed neophyte agent, was sent in the early days of the anxious wartime winter of 1942 to the Washington field office. It was a time when the home front remained on edge, still unnerved by the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, and wondering what might come next. While across the Atlantic, the war in Europe was shaping up to be a long, no-holds-barred brawl, with the prospects for victory seeming more and more beyond the Allies' grasp. Bob was eager to do his part. Straight off, he was apprenticed, as he was promisingly informed, to an experienced agent. Yet what were his mentor's experiences? As far as Bob could tell, he had measured out his years in the Bureau filling out forms and obeying countless regulations, and now he'd been designated to pass on this dull knowledge to his protégé. It was a grim apprenticeship. Bob learned how to sign in and out of the office each day with an automaton's precision, to make sure there was always a number 3 card on file to show what case he was working on at the moment, to fill out the 302s detailing his daily progress on any investigation, to update each month the serial numbers of any firearms he owned, and on and bureaucratically on. Worse, the constant monitoring, the lack of independence, let alone the lack of trust, were not just gnawing, but, Bob felt, offensive. Coffee breaks, a telling example, were prohibited. In this draconian world, they were viewed as nothing less than fraud, the theft of government time. If you had knowledge that one of your fellow field agents was breaking even the most minor of rules, you were duty-bound to report him. Yet those who did were branded with the epithet of submarine, i.e., they attacked with stealth, by their more laissez-faire colleagues. If you were not at home and reachable at the phone number on file, the Bureau required you to call in every 2 hours. Even the unexpected good fortune of spending a night at a girlfriend's house was no excuse. You still had better call to leave the number with the office before settling in. And don't even think you could get away with an evening off the leash. The Bureau would randomly telephone an agent's home, checking to see if he was in, and woe be it the next day to the man who had been negligent enough to go off without leaving a contact number. Bob loathed all these stringent rules, and the more he felt squeezed by them, the more he wanted to rebel. Taking orders was one thing, but this was tedious and demeaning. The Bureau, he felt, was constantly looking over his shoulder, monitoring his every move. By both instinct and disposition, he was still the free spirit whose greatest pleasure was wandering off into the hills. He didn't need a watchdog. He was beginning to wonder if he had made a disastrous mistake. Bob was quietly suffering through this raw, uneasy mood when his first field assignment came in. He was ordered to Birmingham, Alabama. The Bureau deliberately threw novice agents into waters far from where they'd been raised, and then observed with cool detachment if they sank or swam. Bob swam. Away from headquarters and Hoover's looming tyrannical presence, life as an FBI agent was a lot closer, he happily discovered, to what he had once imagined it might be. There were still the petty regulations, the daunting mountains of paperwork, and the puritanical restrictions on personal conduct and dress, but there was also the chance to be a cop working for the best team in the country. The special agent in charge, SAC, of the office took careful measure of Bob, apparently liked what he saw in this gruff, strapping, quietly confident young man, and then turned him loose to work on an eclectic slew of wartime cases. There was Bob, joining in a raid on a series of brothels adjacent to an army base in Tennessee, checking into whether a death at a defense plant in Huntsville might be a murder. It wasn't. And looking into suspected sabotage at coastal dockyards. While in the process, going around the South, flashing his gold badge and bureau credentials, he experienced something that was as gratifying as it was unexpected. Despite his youth, people instinctively respected him. It was a time, he would recall, when the FBI agent was a king, and Bob, although new to the throne, quickly took to all its trappings. He enjoyed the prestige his bureau employment conferred. For Bob, the South was a friendly, hospitable place. People were always going out of their way to invite a new agent to dinner, buy him a beer, or simply introduce themselves and ask if there was anything they could do to make his time in Birmingham more comfortable. Not least of the perks, Bob, who always had a mischievous eye for the ladies, encountered a bevy of agreeable young women as he traveled across the South. But he couldn't help finding their manner too restrained, too genteel. He liked a woman who knew how to laugh, he'd say with a sly grin. For Bob, this was no casual metaphor. Rather, it was a very specific desire. One woman's throaty, naughty laugh had captured Bob's heart and continued to echo evocatively in his memory. He had met Geraldine Elder, everyone called her Jerry, at a frat party back when he had been attending the University of Idaho. But Jerry was not your typical co-ed. She had been raised largely by her maternal grandmother, a beaver trapper, on a remote Wyoming ranch. When her grandmother died, her father, an itinerant barber, took over her upbringing, and she traveled with him across the Pacific Northwest. Yet despite this vagabond childhood, a life where making ends meet was always a tense challenge, Jerry had managed not only to go to school but to excel. Her elementary school teachers, who skipped her one grade, and then, still impressed by her abilities, another for good measure, judged her the smartest girl in the class. and with a pert, aquiline nose, fierce blue eyes, and a smile as wide, bright, and fresh as the great outdoors of her childhood, she was, it was generally conceded, darn near the prettiest, too. By the time Bob first saw her across the room at the frat party, Jerry had already made up her mind to quit college. She was determined to learn how to fly, and soon took a bookkeeping job to pay for the lessons. She was a natural pilot, with a steady hand on the stick and a soul full of daring. Nearly 3 years later, when Bob, after a deluge of ardent letters and long-distance phone calls, had convinced her to marry him and move across the country to live in Alabama, Jerry had established a reputation as one of the few pilots in Idaho who'd ferry smoke jumpers into the very heart of a blazing forest. The wedding took place in March 1942 in Birmingham, just the two of them and a preacher. And it wasn't long before both newlyweds realized they'd made a colossal mistake. What they admired in each other, the certitude, the determination, the uncompromising ambition, were rock-hard qualities that collided time after time in the petty course of married life. They were, it was growing painfully clear, too alike to be comfortable sharing a future together. Then, 3 rocky months after the wedding, the Bureau intervened to make an already deteriorating situation much worse. Bob was transferred to New York. The big city was a world away from the big sky country where they'd been raised. Nothing was familiar. Nothing offered a sense of peace or safety. 30 years later, Bob still fiercely held a small-town person's distaste for the raucous, frantic, ultra-modern tempo of New York. For Jerry, who in her previous life had literally piloted her small plane into the eye of an inferno, to step off a curb and into traffic was an adventure. They found a claustrophobic 3-room apartment in Jackson Heights, Queens, and no sooner had they moved in than they both were looking for a way out. Thanks to the war, Jerry found it first. She volunteered for the Women's Flying Training Detachment and was quickly accepted into the first class of women aviators. In November, she eagerly hightailed it to Houston for training. She never came back to New York, or, for that matter, to Bob. In fact, after her much-decorated service in the war, Jerry, along with her new husband, ran, for decades, a bush pilot service that crisscrossed Alaska. Bob, fearful of portraying himself as rash, waited what he hoped was a sufficiently decorous 4 months before informing the Bureau of the change in his marital status. In March 1943, he wrote Inspector Acers, his superior in the New York field office, "An agreement has been reached between the writer and his wife that they are to remain separated, and a divorce is contemplated. Both the writer and his wife believe this is desirable in view of the fact that the marriage has not been happy or successful." But he took care to reassure the inspector that "the marital difficulty is not the outgrowth of any quarrel, and there has been no infidelity or anything of that nature." Inspector Acers, however, was not placated. He dashed off a censorious note to the director, insisting that Bob's glib explanation of his impending divorce was illogical. And Hoover, now also chagrined, in turn notified the SAC of the New York office to closely observe the work of Agent Lamphere and submit a special efficiency rating on him. Although there were raised eyebrows in the Bureau, for Bob, being a bachelor again was liberating. He got out of the stifling Queen's apartment, found a room for $45 a month in a hotel off Gramercy Park in Manhattan, and, as he happily recalled, "footloose, I began to enjoy the city's distractions." He discovered the smoke-filled late-night glamour of nightclubs. Café Society and the Astor Roof were his frequent haunts. And in wartime New York, a city whose young men had gone off in droves to fight the Nazis, Bob encountered armies of abandoned women.
He felt, he'd concede, a bit of guilt that he was still on the home front while their boyfriends were off in distant places waging war. But with a pragmatic shrug and a wry smile, he came to terms with the situation. A handsome fox turned loose in the chicken coop. He did his best to console the many lonely women he met. To his surprise, Bob was now having a wonderful time in New York. There was only one drawback: his job. The New York field office has always been the Bureau's largest and busiest. In the 1940s, it employed more than 1,000 of the FBI's approximately 7,000 agents. Bob felt diminished, painfully insignificant, in this sea of white shirts and snap-brim hats. And while in Alabama Bob had been given the latitude to run his cases as he saw fit, in New York he was just one small voice in a large chorus. The bosses set the tune, and he was expected to sing along. Still, he was kept busy. In 3.5 years he made more than 400 arrests. Nearly all involved selective service cases, Bob doggedly traipsing through the streets of New York to track down draft dodgers. It was an assignment that reinforced Bob's growing misgivings about missing the war. The city's sidewalks were a long way from the front lines, and he couldn't help feeling he was shirking his duty, especially since his brother Art was in the thick of things in the Pacific. He was giving serious thought to quitting the FBI and volunteering for the Army. With his experience, he'd get assigned to G2, the intelligence division, he expected. But that was before the incident in Chinatown. New York Local Selective Service Board No. 1 had more delinquent cases than any local board in the country. This statistic, however, was deceiving. Since the Lower Manhattan Board's authority extended to both the flophouses of the Bowery and the immigrant tenements of Chinatown, not every man who failed to report for service was trying to shirk his patriotic duty. The young men living a troubled, down-and-out life on the Bowery rarely got around to checking their mail, and many of the recent arrivals from China had offered up an invented name to the immigration authorities when they entered America, and then immediately reverted to their old family name once they were living and working in New York. Draft board notices, as a consequence, often went undelivered. FBI agents, though, didn't want to hear any stories. They routinely insisted ignorance was no excuse. You break the law, you get hauled off to jail. Bob, however, was sympathetic. His treatment of these nuanced cases was more understanding, more shaped by a sagacious diplomacy than the strict a-law-is-a-law arrests carried out routinely by other G-men assigned to Board 1. And his demeanor was noticed. His tact was appreciated. He developed a growing reputation for even-handedness among the family groups who ruled Chinatown. He was often a guest at elaborate dinners where exotic delicacies were served, foods that Bob could not have even begun to imagine in his Idaho boyhood. The An Leon Tong, the Hip Sing Tong, and the Chinese Merchants Association all saw this young, broad-shouldered, round-eyed FBI agent as someone they could trust. It was these elders who told Bob about Thomas John Whalen. Whalen, as Bob observed firsthand when he checked out the story he'd been told, was a U.S. Treasury agent who was running a lucrative shakedown racket in the back rooms of Chinatown. Flashing his badge, Whalen would charge into businesses, demanding to inspect the books. "I want to see the records of the Social Security payments you've been making for your employees," he'd order. When these records could not be produced, because almost invariably the required payments to the government had not been made, Whalen would huff and puff with indignant authority that he had no choice but to cart the merchant immediately off to jail. "You're facing 5 years," he'd growl. "You'll be deported." Then, having brandished the stick, he'd offer the carrot. "Of course," he'd go on conspiratorially,
He would be willing to forget about the whole thing in exchange for a cash payment of $500. Or $1,000, if he thought the merchant could afford it. Whalen had successfully pulled this routine about a dozen times before Bob was alerted. And the next time Whalen tried it, Bob was hiding in an adjacent room, listening to it all go down. As had been previously agreed, the merchant paid his money, and Bob, now a witness to the crime, waited until Whalen was back out on the street to make his arrest. Bob announced, "FBI, you're under arrest." And then Whalen drew his service revolver. Bob pulled out his .38. It was a standoff. Two government agents, guns drawn, facing each other on a busy Chinatown street. Only now, Whalen, with a shrewdness born out of desperation, began to appeal to the gathering crowd. "I'm a Treasury agent. You know me. This man is trying to rob me. He's not with the FBI." And the gathering multitudes took one look at the two armed men and quickly decided that age trumped youth. The Treasury agent had to be the one telling the truth. All at once, Bob could feel the crowd closing in on him. Later, he would say, it was fortunate that he was too scared to think. Instead, he tightened his pull on the trigger of his gun and declared in what he hoped was a clear, steady voice, "Whalen, you have two choices. Either you lower your gun, or I'm going to shoot you straight through the heart." Whalen lowered his gun. In the aftermath of Bob's gutsy showdown, the Bureau, as the now laudatory appraisal in his new fitness report indicated, began to realize that maybe they had been wrong about Lamphere. Perhaps he was the sort of agent who embodied the staunch virtues of fortitude and commitment that Hoover had decreed. And Bob, exhilarated by the moment's sudden challenge and proud of his finding the instincts to live up to its demands, began once again to believe that he had a meaningful future in the FBI. Only the Bureau, wanting to reward him for both his ingenuity and courage, assigned Bob to the Soviet Espionage, S.E., squad. And Bob at once felt betrayed. His suddenly promising career had just as suddenly been channeled into a very dead end. He was being relegated to an obscure and inconsequential Bureau outpost. The Russians, after all, were our wartime allies. They weren't cooking up any nefarious plots. Getting assigned to S.E., he was bitterly certain, was like being shipped off to Siberia. 3. As Bob, grudging and uncertain, was beginning his new job, a stone's throw across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., in a former junior college for fashionable young women that had been hastily transformed into a top-secret government facility, Meredith Gardner was moving into his own new battle. The Blue Problem. But unlike Bob, Meredith was excited by the prospect of throwing himself into the midst of this baffling challenge. The truth was, in so many ways, Meredith was the personification of everything that the gun-toting, good-time-loving, nightclub-hopping FBI agent was not. Just a quick glance revealed the deep, fundamental differences. Meredith was long, lanky, and ascetic, a man whose very thinness seemed to suggest that all the fun had been long ago squeezed out of him. He had a fondness for tweed sport coats, rep-striped ties, and button-down white Oxford shirts, a deliberately donnish attire. Dark horn-rimmed glasses, and a shock of unruly black hair that fell across his forehead as if blown by a sudden gust of wind, further helped to evoke the image of a grad student perpetually heading to his next seminar. Proudly, Meredith was a thinker, a man who took refuge in ideas. He collected them with an indiscriminate passion. Yet all was orderly. Whenever he found something that caught his interest, a curious fact about beetle morphology, the past tense conjugation of a Japanese verb, a tasty brand of biscuit, He'd jot down these little treasures on index cards, and then, when he could find the time, transcribe them into one of his many gray-covered schoolboy notebooks. It was his habit to quote Lucretius's prescription for a life well lived. He knows what it is to know. Meredith, too, strived to reach a similar state of grace. He infused his own life with a deep, constant, joyful pursuit of knowledge. And, like the pensive Lucretius, he found beauty in abstractions. He enjoyed thinking about thought. And while Bob seemed to come to life in a crowded, smoke-filled barroom with a glass of scotch in his hand, Meredith's demeanor, even after a drink or two, was private to the point of being totally self-absorbed. This shyness was both a natural reticence and a well-developed defense against any bore who might try to penetrate his decidedly inward existence. People, especially those who didn't know him well, had a tendency to dismiss his detachment as arrogance, but that was too rash and too shallow an appraisal. More often than not, it was simply that he wasn't interested in what anyone else had to say. What was going on in his mind was enough for him. Still, he could be judgmental, even haughty. Meredith insisted on precision in thought and in expression. Let someone offhandedly complain that it was a million degrees outside, and he couldn't help but point out that, if that were indeed the case, we'd all evaporate. Similarly, he'd pounce when decimate was used imprecisely. And all he had to do was hear, at this point in time, and he'd explode with a grouchy lecture about the annoying and unnecessary redundancy in the phrase. Meredithisms, his co-workers, more often with indulgent shrugs than not, called these frequent corrections. Given his stiff, on occasion even hostile, demeanor, it's perhaps understandable that Meredith didn't make friends easily. But that never concerned him. He could not see the need. And, as for conversation, he made do by talking to himself. One of his colleagues waggishly passed this small joke around. A gardener's best friend is his mutter. The punchline, such as it was, predicated on Mutter being the German for mother. His was a circumspect life. He liked ideas, words, genealogy, crossword puzzles, a glass of sweet sherry, his pipe, or, if that wasn't handy, an unfiltered Camel, and solving unsolvable problems. And because Meredith knew he was very good at what he did, he was, in his solitary, undemonstrative way, quite content. But most strikingly, of all the polar differences between these two young men, between the gregarious plow horse and the solitary deep thinker, when Meredith arrived at the former girls' college, Arlington Hall, he was, at just 30, already a legend. Every genius, it has been said, needs the spark that will ignite his unique mind. And for Meredith, this catalytic moment occurred when he was 8. The year was 1920, and he was living in a down-at-the-heels, clabbered rooming house in Austin, Texas, that his mother Corrine ran because it was the only way she could think of making ends meet. Just a year earlier, the Gardiners, a family that could proudly trace their roots back to Queen Margaret of Scotland, had been settled happily in the deep south cotton belt town of Okolona, Mississippi. But then Daniel Gardiner suddenly died, leaving his widow and their two boys nearly penniless. Corrine made her way to Austin, somehow scratched together the money to buy a rickety home that desperately needed a fresh coat of paint, and put out a sign announcing rooms to let. In the years after World War I, Austin was beginning to flex its muscles as a city. Businesses were opening, and newcomers kept arriving, and the rooms were quickly taken. And Meredith, though enrolled in grade school, was expected to help out. One of his responsibilities was to deliver the mail to their boarders. That was how he saw the newspaper. It was a Yiddish language paper that was received by a tenant whose name and occupation have long been forgotten. But what was remembered, and decades later Meredith shared the memory with his son with a genuine trace of bewilderment, was how the exotic Hebrew letters and the strange words had found